From KCRW in Los Angeles and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Jamil Smith, one of your hosts for the special series 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. Today, income inequality. The richest 1% of Americans control about 38% of the wealth in the United States. Analysts report that the Republican tax bill, very soon to be the Republican tax law, will only exacerbate the problem. And how will this break down on racial and ethnic lines? Today, we'll look at what this legislation will do for certain Americans and what it'll do to others. That's coming up on 1 year later, after headlines from NPR.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
We're back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jamil Smith, contributing opinion writer at the Los Angeles Times. President Trump was in a good mood this morning, thanks to the tax bill.
The heart of our bill is a tremendous amount of relief for the middle class, including a doubling of the child tax credit and a nearly doubling of the standard deduction. That's going to be tremendous for people. They're going to start seeing the results in February. This bill means more take-home pay. It will be an incredible Christmas gift for hardworking Americans. I said I wanted to have it done before Christmas. We got it done.
How much of that can we believe, though? Yes, the bill offers most American taxpayers a cut in the short term, but analysts claim that it will only worsen America's income inequality crisis, one that is demarcated along racial and ethnic lines. I want to welcome my first guest, Heather Long, economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather, thanks for joining us on 1 year later.
Great to be here, Jamil.
Heather, you wrote that this legislation offers a chance to examine many questions facing the nation. One of them is how much the government should try to shrink economic inequality. This bill would actually help government explode economic inequality, according to most reputable analysis. How does it do that specifically?
Well, it's pretty easy to explain. So, as you said, just about everyone in America is going to get either a tax cut next year or pay about the same as they do now. So only 5% of taxpayers will pay more. But the issue is that the folks in the middle and the working poor, they're getting a much smaller tax cut. Now, of course, readers and listeners immediately say, well, of course the rich people, the millionaires, of course they're going to get more money back because they're richer. So, you know, to give $1 million person, you got to give them, say, $100,000 back to be the same as giving, you know, a middle-class person their 10%. So the way that economists and analysts look at this is they say, okay, let's look at the change in after-tax income. So what percent are people's after-tax income's going to go up? And when they do that analysis, the middle gets about a 2% raise from this tax bill. The working poor get about a 1% raise, if that, and the folks making $500,000 or $1 million or more, those folks are getting a 4% after-tax raise. So that their incomes are just going to grow so much faster than anybody at the bottom.
You wrote that the tax overhaul was the easy part for Republicans. What is next, and why will that be more difficult?
I was actually speaking to some White House sources this morning, and the president and his team were sitting down this morning debating what's next. And they were debating between two things. Did they tackle infrastructure next? It has a lot of broad bipartisan support. Got to fix our roads and our bridges and our trains and our airports, which many people think are an embarrassment. Or do they go and start targeting welfare? And they really see this as a chance to get more Americans off of various welfare and safety net programs and get them jobs, not that the economy is doing so well. But the, you know, the fear among folks who care about inequality is, okay, we've just given this big tax cut to the wealthy and it's risen the debt, and now we're going to turn around and we're going to scale back programs that really help families earning $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicare, Medicaid, and various food stamps or the SNAP program.
Yeah, right after the wealthiest Americans have been given a giant tax cut. I just want to pivot to one thing that one of our listeners called in and told us. Now, of course, on this program, we also reach out to listeners and ask them to comment on our topics. Well, let's hear now from a retired accountant in Missouri responding to the tax bill.
My name is Bob Kenny, and I live in St. Louis. I'm a Republican. I was not a big Trump supporter in the primary, but I voted for him because I'm still happier with Trump than I would have been under Hillary Clinton. I think a lot of the problems, a lot of the worry, is a result of Democratic Party propaganda. I have analyzed the bill as it affects the people I know, and I can see that for a good number of the lower middle class people I know, the bill will substantially reduce their tax liability. I also know a fair number of small business people who currently have to pay the Obamacare penalty or take the Obamacare insurance. And these people have always loathed that particular feature of Obamacare. And so they will be happier. They won't be forced to take insurance that, quite frankly, is grossly overpriced and that they don't use. So from where I see it in the Midwest, it's a positive, and it helps the lower middle class and some very small businessmen make a living.
Heather, what do you say to that?
Jamil, I would say Bob from Missouri is exactly the reason that I have been saying this bill is going to be, or very likely to be, a win for Republicans in the short term. So a win for Republicans heading into the 2018 midterm election.
Mm.
The reality is the U.S. economy is doing better than it was a year ago. Unemployment's down, growth is up, and that trend was already looking strong heading into 2018. Now we're just spending $1.5 trillion to give it even more of a juicy bump. So the economy is likely to look very strong in 2018. And as people realize, like Bob, they plug in their numbers on calculators on the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and other places, and they say, whoa, I'm actually getting several hundred dollars, if not several thousand dollars, back from this plan. I think he's right. I think the sentiment in the short term is this doesn't look as bad as I thought it was going to be. The problem is all the benefits, or most of the benefits, are front loaded.
Mm-hmm.
And so the real problems in this bill, like what you're talking about, are that it runs up the debt and it worsens inequality.
Right.
But you're not going to realize that in the first 6 months.
Mm. Well, more cake for the rich, as long as we get our crumbs, I guess. I want to bring in two other guests into this discussion. Paul Keel covers consumer finance for ProPublica. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you.
And Tim Noah is the labor policy editor for Politico and the author of the book, The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to One Year Later, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
Tim, I want to start with you. You wrote a book on this issue, of course. And so what is the difference between economic inequality and wealth inequality?
Well, there are many different kinds of economic inequality. Wealth inequality is one kind. The kind that I've tended to focus on is income inequality. I think it's a more meaningful statistic because when you look at wealth inequality, wealth inequality is so great that there are, you know, there's a vast portion of the population that has virtually no wealth. And it's very tricky to think of policy options to address wealth inequality. Income inequality is different. Almost everybody has income. Income is kind of where we live in an industrial society or post-industrial society. And there are policies that affect income inequality. So I think it's a more useful thing to look at.
Let me ask you, Paul, how is wealth inequality institutionalized in America, and what impact has President Trump had on that in the past year?
Well, in terms of impact he's had on it, I don't know. He's only been there for so long. I think the thing I think about is, I mean, a lot of things I write about are what happens when something goes wrong for people. The last Federal Reserve survey found that if they were asked to come up with $400 in an emergency, about 45% of households says they couldn't do that. And what happens when people are hit with those types of emergencies are bad things. So they fall behind on debts. They get sued over debts. It runs the gamut from that. And, people losing their driver's license because they can't pay certain fines. So there's, you know, there's people who live in a constant state of possible emergency should anything go wrong. And it's useful to keep in mind that we're in the midst of a very long economic expansion, and there's all these policies that are supposedly going to, they want to juice the economy is the goal. And along those lines, there's a recent photo op that I guess Trump had with this pile of, red tape, tape and the regulations and how they're going to destroy regulations. It reminded me of a photo op that bank regulators had back in 2003, and they're going to get rid of all the red tape around bank regulation. And one of them had garden shears, and they were going to cut the red tape. The other one had a chainsaw. And we know how that, that ended up. So this makes me think of, how far is Wile E. Coyote going to make it off the cliff before he looks down?
Let's listen to another call that we received. It's from an actor here in Los Angeles responding to the tax bill.
Hi, my name is William Charlton, and I'm an actor. I live in Los Angeles. I serve on the SAG-AFTRA National Board as well as the Los Angeles Local Board. I think the tax bill is horrendous for working performers or anybody working in the entertainment business who is unincorporated and making, less than $100,000 a year. We're all going to see our tax bills go up by anywhere between $1,000 to $4,000. Most importantly is that we will no longer be able to write off the monies that we pay to our agents and our managers, which often amount to as much as 25 or 30% of our income. And this is hard. It's harsh for us because we itemize on Form 2106, and it's my understanding that this itemization is gone, which just means that middle-class performers are going to see their taxes go up. It's important to remember that there are a lot of middle-class actor performers and below-the-line crew who make less than $100,000 a year. They're not rich. We're just struggling to make a living. And the fact that we could itemize our expenses helped us in that. I think it's focus on investors as opposed to wage earners is, what's the word I'm looking for? It's treachery. it's for example, this the man who is our president at the moment ran on the idea that he wanted to give workers back their ability to earn a living. And this tax bill emphasizes investment, and it doesn't give a tax break to the wage earner, which is where it should have been. So it increases inequality in our country as far as I'm concerned.
Heather, I want to ask you, how do you explain the fact that we heard two fundamentally different views from people who both identify as working class or middle class?
Well, so the actor in Los Angeles, I had a very similar conversation recently with musicians from the National Symphony Orchestra here in D.C. So those folks do fall into that 5% who will face a tax increase next year. It's what I would say, it's not so much that this bill doesn't help wage earners. It does help most wage earners, but one of the flaws of this bill is that it doesn't seem to address the gig economy type workers. So whether those can be the actors or the musicians at the National Symphony. I've also talked to nurses who travel a lot, who may spend a couple months in Los Angeles, a couple months in San Antonio. They would be hurt by the provision he's talking about, unreimbursed business expenses going away. I've also talked to people who work on nuclear power plants, who service our nuclear power plants. They have a mostly traveling job, and this, similar to the gig economy, this bill does not help them, and it's an odd choice to make, as that seems to be the future of work, to not be having a bill that would prioritize that.
Tim, I want to ask your response to what William, the actor in Los Angeles, had to say.
Well, I can't address the particulars of a situation for actors, but I would say this. There are actually two types of income inequality in this country. There is the 1% versus the 99%. That is the inequality that consists of a wildly disproportionate amount of the national income going to the very richest people in America. And then there's a more mundane version of income inequality, which is the growing disparity between people who have college degrees and people who don't. That first type of inequality, which lately has has been the most glaring form of growing income inequality. That first type will be worsened by this bill. Hard to say by how much, but when you look at the various taxes and how they affect incomes, the corporate tax affects incomes for people at the very top much more so than, say, the personal income tax. But, you know, the caveat here is that the tax bill will also raise incomes for that group of college graduates, or many of them. It'll raise taxes for professionals, unless they manage to figure out some way to get their income as pass through or through various other tricks that are made available under the bill. And the interesting thing about that group of people is, you know, these moderately wealthy professionals tend not to vote Republican. So this tax, among other things, is very efficiently targeted to raise taxes among sort of key Democratic constituencies and lower them for key Republican constituencies.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there for a bit and take a short break. I want to thank Heather Long, economics correspondent at The Washington Post, for joining us. Thank you, Heather.
Great conversation.
Thank you. And if you want to chime in on this discussion, I want you to go to our website. It's kcrw.org/one year later. And after the break, we'll continue this. We're talking about inequality. We're talking about the tax bill. We want to ask also, what does race have to do with income inequality in this country? This is One Year Later on KCRW. Welcome back. I'm Jamil Smith, and this is One Year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. In light of the new tax bill that just passed today, we're talking about economic inequality, income inequality. To do that, I'm joined by Paul Keel, who covers consumer finance for ProPublica, and by Tim Noah, who is the labor policy editor for Politico and the author of the book The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. Paul, I want to start with you. In your role, you cover people who have gone bankrupt, who are sued for their debt, and who have had their wages garnished. What's the meaning of wealth in situations like that?
It's your protection against that sort of thing. So it's your buffer. And so along racial lines, you know, we have an income gap in this country that's quite material. But then if you look at wealth, that is vastly larger. So the most recent study by the Federal Reserve put it at 10 to 1 in terms of the typical wealth of a white family to a typical black family. And so what happens when something goes wrong and there's no buffer, and sometimes these effects are magnified through, social ties, everyone else is kind of is similarly vulnerable. So it makes it much harder to fend off, not being able to pay a credit card or a medical bill, that sort of thing. And then you end up in sort of a cascading series of events that can sometimes go on for years.
Paul, you wrote a story, co-wrote a story, I should say, in September about this exact kind of thing. You say black people who struggle with debts are far less than their white peers to gain lasting relief from bankruptcy. Can you tell us a specific story that helps illuminate that?
Yeah. So, I mean, kind of a hinge point that people don't tend to think about is it costs money to hire an attorney to file for bankruptcy. So, what we saw in the national numbers was that particularly black debtors were ending up in Chapter 13. Chapter 13 is like a payment plan you do over 5 years. But the reason that they were ending up in Chapter 13 is because they're allowed to pay attorneys over time as opposed to having to come up with $1,000 to pay an attorney up front. And the effect of that was that they were unable to Complete the plans because, you know, stuff happens over the course of 5 years, and then end up right back where they started. And so it was sort of a thing that was helping to worsen this this cycle of not being able to get out of, you know, a problem. And so the one of the women I focused on in the piece, and I focused on Memphis because it has the highest bankruptcy filing rate in the country, you know, she had a car that she you know, had trouble affording. She had this really high cost loan. And then on top of that, she had this horrible situation with her apartment that had bed bugs and roaches. And so she broke her lease. But then her landlord came after her and sued her for a vast amount of money that was run up by fees, you know, from the collection company and the attorney. And then she's being stuck with maybe having her wages garnished. You know, she's not making much money. She's a single mom with kids. So someone who's barely hanging on and then ends up in a Chapter 13 bankruptcy because that's what she can afford to do, predictably fails out and is right back where she started. And this is, you know, thing that could potentially go on for years, just living in the constant fear that, you know, tomorrow she's going to open up her paycheck and a quarter of it's going to be gone. So that's how a lot of people live. And, you know, there's not a lot of policies that are being talked about to help people in those types of situations.
Mm. Tim, on that note, what are some of the policies that should be, you know, discussed right now? And Paul, I want to ask you the same question after Tim responds.
Well, it feels a little pie in the sky at the moment because the political forces are arrayed against most of the policy levers for reducing income inequality. more progressive taxation reduces income inequality, but we're seeing the tax code become more regressive, at least at the top, and it's a more complex picture for the upper middle class. Another policy that we're a long way from is policies that support labor unions. And here we've seen over the last week a string of decisions from the National Labor Relations Board that serve to make it more difficult for workplaces to unionize and also more difficult to hold large corporations accountable for labor violations committed by their franchisees and their subcontractors. So those are two right there. Fed policy plays into it. Policies towards the world of finance certainly play into it, and we've seen the Trump administration move to weaken some of the rules that came out of the Dodd-Frank legislation a few years ago. So I think one can say with some confidence that that the policies of the Trump administration are moving steadily to increase income inequality.
Paul, in your reporting, what have you identified as possible solutions, solutions from economic experts or from local leaders or activists?
Yeah, I mean, I think my perspective is just don't make things worse, right? So you have policies such as, you know, you get hit with a traffic ticket and you have trouble paying it, and so you lose your driver's license. You now are faced with, do I try to drive to my job with a suspended license and then end up in jail, or do I lose my job? You know, these are sorts of policies that don't make sense to most people, I think, if they think about it. Overly punitive debt collection laws, bail reform, you know, types of things where people are punished for being poor. And then looking at financial products. So that is one area where the Trump administration has been finally effective. You know, they've been looking to take over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is one of the most effective things that came out of the Dodd-Frank bill. And they finally got someone in there in charge that can put the brakes on everything. There's a payday loan bill that would require payday lenders to check to make sure that their customers can actually afford the loans that they're taking out, and which for that reason the industry bitterly opposes. And the question now is whether Republicans in Congress can muster enough votes with a couple of Democrats, I should add, to overturn that. So there's a lot of policies. You know, the Obama administration over 8 years was able to pass some really significant legislation. There's a bill in 2009 that really added new regulations to subprime credit cards that really cut down a lot of those abuses. And there's some of that stuff I think we've maybe taken for granted. And you know, having an effective, relatively effective, consumer financial regulator that was out there, you know, punishing banks for, deceptive, credit card practices and stuff like that. As that goes away, you know, there's not necessarily going to be major consequences for the economy immediately. But as we saw in the Bush years, this gradual, you know, snowball of deregulation can eventually reach a crisis point.
Mm. Tim, I want to pivot to a broader question, and I'm not sure necessarily that this is something that you may regard as a stupid question or whatnot, but I just want to make sure that we broach the topic because I feel like maybe there are people that feel this way. Why is inequality inherently a bad thing?
I get asked that a lot.
Yeah.
I get asked that a lot. And before I answer it, I always preface it by saying that this is a question that never would have been asked 100 years ago and it never would have been asked 50 years ago. The reason it was never would have been asked 100 years ago was because this country was closer than it's ever been, really, to being overthrown by radicals. There was a huge terror on the part of capitalists that socialists or anarchists would seek to overthrow the country. And so it was obvious to them that if income inequality got too out of hand, they might have a revolution on their hands. That's why the question never came up 100 years ago. 50 years ago, the question never came up because the United States was competing with the Soviet Union for the hearts and minds of other nations. And it was understood that it would not help the United States case if income inequality got too far out of hand. Today, communism is no longer much of a threat, and there's no realistic likelihood that anarchists or socialists or communists are going to overthrow the country. So the question finally does come up. And I would argue that there are a number of reasons we need to care about income inequality, but the main one is that it makes us a more tribal country. It creates hatreds. I think we're seeing that. There's greater tribalism in our politics today. It also weakens the middle class, which in turn weakens democracy. There's a famous quote from the sociologist Barrington Moore. He said, no middle class, no bourgeois, no democracy. And so those are things to worry about. In times of greater income inequality, we see much larger divisions, partisan divisions in Congress. That's been documented. Today, Congress is actually more divided along partisan lines than it was even during the period of Reconstruction. So stop and think about that. During the period of Reconstruction, there were people in Congress who just a few years earlier had been shooting at each other. And yet that Congress was less divided along partisan lines than what we see today.
Now, Paul, I know you've written a lot about the foreclosure crisis as well. How much does the overall climate of housing and also discrimination that plays into that, how does that factor into what we see with wealth and income inequality?
Well, I mean, what we saw with the past crisis was particularly among Black homeowners were just completely decimated because it's sort of there's two effects that went on. One is that the worst lending practices tended to be more prevalent in communities of color. And the second was that they had a disproportionate amount of their wealth in their homes. So when house prices started tumbling, they were disproportionately affected because they didn't have a good portion of their wealth in other places like stocks and bonds and that kind of stuff. So it can magnify the effects that are already there.
Mm. So Tim, I want to have you respond also to that. How do other factors that within the society play into a growing income inequality crisis?
Well, income inequality is growing around the world. And what I tried to look at in my book is the question, why is it growing so much faster and why is it so much worse in the United States than it is in other comparable countries? You know, there are factors like globalization that affect all of the industrial democracies, but they have affected the United States more. And why is that? And I think there are a number of reasons, but I think the decline of labor unions has played a particularly large role in that. And I think it's going to be very difficult to address the income inequality problem without addressing the decline of labor unions. Mm. All these regulatory issues that we were talking about earlier may collectively matter more with regard to income inequality than the tax cut. Because remember, income inequality has been growing in the United States since 1979, and it's a pre-tax phenomenon. Tax policy can affect income inequality, but it has not been the driver of income inequality. The driver has really been other government policies that encourage the amassing of income at the very top of the scale.
Paul, last quick question. We have about a few minutes left. I just want to, there's another element to wealth inequality that you've mentioned in your stories, the person's ability to borrow money from a family member or friend in times of need, regardless of income. Can you explain that briefly and how it works? Is that like secondhand wealth where you belong to, you know, one community and what have you?
So it's sort of that these, you know, we're talking about a racial wealth gap. It's the sort of thing that's compounded by the fact that all the people around you, if you're black, happen to also be black, and so there's no place to go. So if, you know, something happens, you're much less likely to be able to rely on a mom or a grandmother or something like that. And kind of to turn that upside down is one thing. Just having done reporting on this issue in various different areas, there's sort of this reverse effect where this person who does have wealth gets overtapped. So the grandmother who owns her home is helping out, you know, her kids and also her grandkids, and then she ends up in a situation where, you know, she's tapped out because, you know, her resources have been drained. And so that's another thing that, you know, can make her more vulnerable because she's overstretched. So it's an effect that kind of magnifies, you know, what's happening on the individual level.
Tim, I want to ask you quickly, you know, we heard a lot about this, especially within Democratic politics over the course of the election, that race and class didn't mix in with regards, especially to labor disputes. Can you briefly talk about that and how that is manifesting in this Trump era?
Well, with regard to income inequality, the growth in income inequality has not in any direct way been driven by racial disparity. But certainly vast racial disparities exist. That can't be questioned. And one of the more depressing statistics is that the income gap between whites and blacks hasn't really changed in any meaningful way since 1979. I think if you got in a time machine, went back to 1979, and you asked people, do you think that the gap, the wage gap between blacks and whites will narrow in the next 40 years, they would have all said yes, and they would all be wrong. You know, in the Trump era, we have seen a legitimization of racial prejudice, and we've seen a worsening of race relations. We've seen a condoning of white nationalism, which I think a lot of us find quite chilling. And Trump has, in theory, been more sympathetic to class divisions, but in fact, his policies are worsening class divisions. Mm-hmm. And I cite the examples of those NLRB decisions, the other regulatory matters we talked about, and this tax cut.
Right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. We have to leave it there. Paul Keel of ProPublica and Tim Noah of Politico. Thank you for joining me, gentlemen.
Thanks. You.
When we come back, what is Trump doing to conservatism? I'll talk it out with my fellow co-host Jennifer Rubin when we continue with One Year Later from KCRW. I'm Jamil Smith, back with One Year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. This is the part of the show where we talk it out, when we talk through the big political stories of the day with two political viewpoints. Since I'm representing the left, we're bringing in Jennifer Rubin, opinion writer and author of the Right Turn blog at The Washington Post, and one of the hosts of One Year Later. Hello, Jennifer. Welcome back.
Nice to be back, Jamil. How's everything going?
All's well. First, let's talk about you.
Oh, my.
A writer from the National Review went after you in a column this week for your consistent criticism of President Trump. Others on the right have come to your defense, including David Frum of The Atlantic magazine. How are you feeling about all this?
It's a bit weird, to be honest, because, of course, I'm used to writing about the conservative movement, not being written about. So it's one of these sort of meta self-conscious moments for me. That said, I clearly have hit a nerve with those I've been criticizing. And as you know from my work and from our discussions, my criticism of Trump has not only been about Trump, but about what I consider to be an intellectually and morally disingenuous conservative movement that has largely tried to overlook his, what I think are gross offenses, tried to excuse them, tried to minimize them, made arguments like, but Gorsuch, as if that justifies other wrongs, and, you know, they don't like it. They're perfectly entitled to not like it, and they respond. If I spent my time responding to every criticism, however, I would not do my job. And since my obligation is to my readers, I think I'll keep on doing my job.
Indeed. I do want to have you actually respond to something David wrote in his defense of you that I thought was fascinating, which is, I'll just read it. It's a little bit of a long quote, but just bear with me. He said, the project of defending him, meaning Trump, against his coming political travails, or at least assailing those who doubt and oppose him, is already changing what it means to be a conservative. The word conservative will, of course, continue to be in use, but its meaning is being rewritten each day by the actions of those who lay claim to the word. Do you feel like conservatism as a concept is under threat during the Trump era?
I find it very difficult these days to use the term because we don't know whom it refers to. When you say conservative, do you mean the people who want to be ideologically pure, like in the Freedom Caucus? Do you mean the people who are running the White House in the name of conservatism, who are advancing very non-conservative views? Do you refer to people like David and I, who consider ourselves to be true to the heritage of Edmund Burke and the neoconservative movement? It's almost become an impossible term because you have to so define which group you mean within that. But I will say this. I think Trump represents an end of an era, an end of a modern conservative era that began with Ronald Reagan. It was somewhat brain dead, frankly, before Trump came along. But this certainly cut it off and ended that period of time. And frankly, you see from the polls that despite political success, because politicians are always the last one to figure things out, that trickle-down economics is very unpopular. Taking away people's health care is very unpopular. There is no great swell and cry to shrink the government back to pre-Depression-level government. So the agenda that they've run on and they've recycled is not in tune with the times and not responsive to the needs that we have. So in some sense, good riddance, put a stake through it.
Right.
But then there becomes the discussion about what follows and what is a meaningful movement that is responsive to the times, but also to some of the temperament that we think of conservatism being associated with modesty, humility, gradualism, skepticism of centralization, all those things which have gone completely out the window because they have power and they want to use it. So it is a fascinating time.
Right. Because it feels like in this moment, liberals, a lot of them, including myself, feel that, you know, Republicans or at least people, I guess, who are opposing Trump, feel that they're trying to protect some kind of image of conservatism or republicanism that was more noble than what Trump symbolizes. And there are a lot of folks on my side who claim that, well, actually, things were pretty bad then, too. Do conservatives respond? How do conservatives respond to that criticism that, in fact, conservatives who oppose Trump, like yourself, are, in fact, you know, maybe defending something that's not worth defending?
Right. I think there's a split. I think some people would get their spine up and say, no, it's been corrupted, it's been changed, it's been diluted by Trump and those who practice it. I have a slightly different reaction, which is, you know, some of the criticism about the right was true. There's a lot of xenophobia over there. There's a lot of racism over there. And so I think it's incumbent upon all of us to do some self-reflection and to figure out what is worth preserving and what's not. That's the essence of conservatism. From an intellectual standpoint, you preserve, you conserve what is good, and you innovate where necessary. So my sense is that conservatism, however you want to define it, went off the tracks a while ago. And this has now put the spotlight on really sort of the intellectual vacuum that exists. Right now it's being filled by populism, which I find noxious and offensive. I'd like to get rid of that. But the question is, what else is there? Is there philosophically another space on the political continuum for people who in the past have been nervous, shall we say, about progressive policies or have been concerned about foreign policy. Although I must say, Democrats and foreign policy these days sound a lot more sane than Republicans.
Well, let's talk about conservative branding a little bit more. Let's talk about the tax bill. It's cleared both houses of Congress and now awaits President Trump's signature, which is probably going to happen in January. Speaking of conservatives, increasing the deficit by this magnitude does not feel very conservative. That's not necessarily what you would have seen as Republicans advocate for in another era. What do you feel about that?
Right. I've written over and over and over again that I'm fine with tax reform. In 1986, Ronald Reagan and a bipartisan congressional majority of all but I think three United States senators voted for a bill that broadened the base, that got rid of a lot of loopholes, and was not a giveaway to the rich. And that's what I think was possible this time had they decided to go that route. And I think there's benefit to doing that. Now, I've not been one of those who thinks that tax cuts are the end all and be all for conservatism or for national prosperity. But this dog's breakfast is an embarrassment. It is a complete budget buster. It was sold on false principles. Just today, the president is confessing that, yes, this is really about corporate tax cuts. It's not really about you little people who I kept promising things to. So the forgotten man and woman has been forgotten again. It's really just a mess, and it's fiscally irresponsible. And what drives me a little nuts is that this was, of all times, a good opportunity to actually do something on a bipartisan, positive basis. And the Republicans just failed on every level. Moderates failed. The White House failed. Paul Ryan, who has really kind of sold himself to the devil in my book, failed. And so what they came out with was this gross caricature of what the Republican Party has always denied they were for, which is for big corporations, big estates, and rich people, particularly rich people who enjoy passive income, don't actually work for a living. So, yes, it's Donald Trump's dream, but I didn't think that that's what conservatism was all about. So I'm very displeased with the product, but I think this is really emblematic of what we were just talking about, Jamil, which is that right now there seems to be no space for the sort of center-right policies I'm talking about. I've been abandoned even by poor Susan Collins and by Bob Corker. I am alone on the island. So I will stand until others join. It's a dispiriting time. I think the tax bill is going to add massive debt to the economy that will suck up growth, that will inevitably lead to tax increases or to cuts in programs that the middle and working class could benefit from. And it's really completely unresponsive to the challenges that we have in a globalized economy with increasing economic inequality. A big disappointment. I know Republicans are patting themselves on the back. They might want to take a look at the polls, which show that about 3/4 of the American people have figured out that this is a scam. But perhaps not. We'll see. Elections are a long time away and people forget. So we'll see.
Yeah, on that note, I mean, Heather Long, the economics correspondent for The Washington Post, your colleague, chimed in earlier in our conversation, said it would be good for the Republicans in the short run that, you know, people like our earlier caller from Missouri feel like this is going to be good for small business and whatnot. What do you say briefly to that?
Well, I've been playing around. Everyone can do this at home, so you can try this at home, with these tax calculators that they have on the Washington Post site and on other newspapers. And what you'll find is huge, huge variations between people at different income levels, depending upon whether you itemize, you don't itemize, what state you live in. And let's also remember what this bill does, which is take away the individual mandate, which, according to most analysis, will push up the cost of premiums purchased on the individual exchange market about 10%. So none other than dear Susan Collins, about a month ago, was saying, you know, if you take away that individual mandate, it's going to swamp any tax savings you get. So, yes, see, Susan Collins of November 15, 2017, I think had it right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there will be people that benefit, I have no doubt. Will the money be directed at people who need it the most? I don't think so.
Yeah.
And will it be substantial so that it changes people's lifestyle and the economy as a whole? I have my doubts.
That's it for us today on 1 Year Later. Meet us back here tomorrow for our show on recreational marijuana and the Green Rush and its racial divides. Today's last note is the OJs for love of money, speaking to the tax bill, and income inequality. And 1 Year Later is a co-production of KCRW Los Angeles and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Bureau International.